all that is too timid to dare to suppress it. Suppress it? Is that possible? Nothing simpler. One repents only of those things one is not in the habit of doing. Practice more often what makes you feel remorse, and you will soon be rid of it. Counter it with the flame of the passions and the powerful laws of self-interest, and you will soon have dispelled it. Remorse is not proof of crime. It is merely evidence of a mind that is easy to subjugate. If some ridiculous order should be made to prevent you from leaving this chamber immediately, you would not leave it without remorse, however certain you might be that you would do no harm in doing so. So, it is not true that crime alone leads to remorse. Having convinced oneself that crime is nothing at all, and is even necessary, given nature's overall plan, it should therefore be possible to conquer the remorse one would feel after committing it, as easily as it would be for you to stifle that which would result from your leaving this room after the illegal order you would have received to stay here. One must begin with a precise analysis of everything men call crime, in order to persuade oneself that it is nothing but the infringement of their laws and their national customs, that what one calls crime in France ceases to be such 200 leagues away, that there is no act that is really considered as a crime all over the world, none that debauched or criminal here is not virtuous and praiseworthy a few miles from here, that all is a matter of opinion, and of geography, and that it is therefore absurd to wish to compel oneself to practice virtues that are nothing but vices elsewhere, and to shun crimes that are excellent actions in another climate. Given these reflections, I ask you now whether I can still feel any remorse for having committed in France, whether out of pleasure or interest, a crime that is quite simply a virtue in China, and whether I should make myself most unhappy and inconvenience myself greatly in order to carry out in France acts that would get me burnt in Siam. Now, if remorse is just a defensive reaction, if it arises simply from the idea of the forbidden and in no way from the action committed, is it an impulse it would be wise to allow to subsist within oneself? Is it not stupid not to suppress it at once? Let us become accustomed to regarding the action that has just given rise to remorse as indifferent. Let us judge it to be so, following a considered review of the manners and customs of all nations of the earth. Consequently, this action, such as it is, should be repeated as often as possible. Or better still, one should commit even graver crimes than the one that's been done in order to get used to it, and habit and reason will soon destroy remorse. They will soon get rid of that gloomy feeling, sole fruit of ignorance and poor education. One will then feel that, as there is no real crime against anything, it is stupid to repent of it, and pusillanimous to dare to do only what can be useful or agreeable to us, whatever the obstacles that must be overcome to achieve it. I am 45 years old, Therese. I committed my first crime at the age of 14. This freed me from all ties that constrained me. Since then, I have not ceased to pursue fortune in a career that has been filled with it. There is nothing that I have not done or caused to be done, and I have never known remorse. However this may be, I am nearing my goal. Just a few more strokes of luck, and I shall pass from the state of mediocrity, in which I was going to end my days, to more than 50,000 livres income a year. I repeat, my dear, I have never felt the pricks of remorse as I have travelled this happy road. Were some awful setback to plunge me this instant from the heights into the abyss, I should not feel it any more. I should complain about others or about my own blunders, but I would still be at peace with my conscience.
So be it then, madame, I replied, but let us reason for a moment according to your own principles. What gives you the right to demand that my conscience should be as harsh as your own, given that it has not been accustomed since childhood to overcome the same prejudices? By what right do you demand that my mind, which is not organized like yours, adopt the same ways of thinking? You admit that there is a balance of good and evil in nature, and that in consequence there is a need for a given number of individuals who do good and another who do evil. The position I adopt is therefore in nature. Given this, how can you demand that I infringe the rules it prescribes for me? You say that you find happiness in the career that you pursue. Well, madame, what makes you think that I would not equally find it in the one I follow? Moreover, do not imagine that the vigilance of the laws leaves those who infringe them alone for long. You've just seen a striking example of this. Of the 15 rogues I was living with, one got away, and 14 perished ignominiously.
And so that's what you call a misfortune, continued Dubois. But what does that ignominy matter to him who no longer has any principles? When one has crossed all boundaries, when in our eyes honour is now simply an antiquated notion, reputation an indifferent thing, religion a myth, death complete oblivion, is it not then the same thing to die on a scaffold as in one's bed? There are two kinds of criminal in the world, Thérèse. Those that a huge fortune and prodigious credit protect from this tragic end, and those who will not be able to avoid it if they are caught. The latter, born into poverty, must have only one desire if they are intelligent, to become rich, whatever the cost. If they succeed, they have what they wished for and are bound to be content. If they are broken on the wheel, what regrets will they have, since they have nothing to lose? The laws are therefore impotent with regard to all villains. As long as the powerful are beyond their reach, it is impossible for the wretched to fear them, since the sword of justice is their only resource.
And do you believe, I replied, that in another world celestial justice does not await those for whom crime has no fears in this one?
If there were a god, this dangerous woman responded, I believe there would be less evil in the world. I believe that if evil does exist here, either such disorder is ordered by this god, in which case he is a barbaric entity, or else he is unable to prevent it. And then he is a weak god. In either case, he is an abominable being, a being whose thunderbolts I am bound to defy and whose laws I must despise. Oh, Thérèse, is not atheism better than either of these extremes? These are my beliefs, dear girl. I have had them since childhood, and I shall doubtless never abandon them as long as I live.
You make me tremble, madame, I said, rising to my feet. Forgive me if I cannot listen any longer to your sophisms and your blasphemies.
One moment, Thérèse, said Dubois, stopping me. If I cannot conquer your mind, at least let me capture your heart. I have need of you. Don't refuse to help me. Here are 1,000 louis. They are yours once the job is done.
At this, following only my inclination to do good, I immediately asked Dubois what was involved in order to prevent, if I could, the crime that she was preparing to commit.
There he is, she said to me. Have you noticed that young merchant from Lyon who has been eating here for 4 or 5 days?
Who? Dubreuil.
Precisely. Well, he has told me in confidence that he is in love with you. He is very taken with your sweet and modest looks. He loves your candour, and he is enchanted by your virtuousness. This romantic lover has 800,000 francs in gold, or in paper money, in a small chest next to his bed. Let me give this man the impression that you agree to listen to him. What does it matter to you one way or the other? I will get him to propose a walk outside town with you. I will persuade him that his suit to you will be advanced during this walk. You will amuse him and keep him outside for as long as possible. Meanwhile, I will rob him, but I will not flee. I will still be in Grenoble while his valuables will be in Turin. We will employ all possible ruses to allay his suspicions. We shall appear to assist him in his investigations. Meanwhile, my departure will be announced and will not surprise him. You will follow me, and 1,000 louis will be paid to you when we reach the territory of Piedmont.
I accept, madame, I said to Dubois, determined to warn Dupreuil of the theft that was being planned. But just consider, I added, the better to deceive this villainous woman, that if Dubreuil is in love with me, by warning him or by giving myself to him, I can obtain far more than you are offering me to betray him.
Bravo!
Dubois said to me, That's what I call a good pupil. I'm beginning to think that heaven has given you a greater gift for crime than me. Anyway, she continued as she wrote, here is my promissory note for 20,000 aku. Dare to refuse me now. How could I do so, madame? I said, taking the note. But you should at least understand that it is because of my wretched condition that I am weak enough and culpable enough to give way to your powers of seduction. I wanted to pay tribute to your intelligence, Dubois said to me, but you prefer me to blame your misfortune. As you wish. Serve me without fail, and you will be content. Everything was arranged. I began to be a little more receptive to Dubreuil's attentions, and I did indeed realize that he had some feelings for me. My situation was extremely awkward. Certainly, I was far from wanting anything to do with the proposed crime, even if there had been 10,000 times more gold on offer. But to denounce this woman was another problem for me. The idea of imperiling the life of a creature to whom I had owed my freedom 10 years earlier was extremely repugnant to me. I would have liked to find a way to prevent the crime without having it punished, and with any other person than a consummate criminal like Dubois, I would have managed to do so. This, then, was what I resolved to do, unaware that this horrible woman's secret scheming would not only upset the entire edifice of my well-meaning plans, but would even punish me for having conceived them. On the appointed day of the planned walk, Dubois invites the two of us to dine in her chamber. We accept, and when the meal is over, Dubreuil and I go down to hasten the carriage that was being made ready for us. As Dubois had not accompanied us, I found myself alone for a moment with Dubreuil before we left.
Monsieur, I said to him in haste, listen to me carefully. Don't create a stir, and above all, observe strictly what I am going to tell you to do. Do you have a friend you can depend on in this inn?
Yes, I have a young associate that I can count on as much as myself.
Well, monsieur, go quickly and instruct him not to leave your chamber for 1 minute all the time that we will be on our walk.
But I have the key to the room. What's the point of such excessive precaution?
It is more essential than you think, monsieur. Avail yourself of it, I beg you, or I shall not go out with you. The woman we dined with is a villain. She has arranged the outing for the two of us just so that she can rob you more easily in the meantime. Hurry, monsieur. She is watching us. She is dangerous. Give your key to your friend so that he may go and wait in your room, and tell him not to budge until we have returned. I will explain all the rest to you as soon as we are in the carriage.
Dupreuil hears what I say and squeezes my hand to thank me. He hurries to instruct his friend accordingly, returns, and we set off. On the way, I explain the whole affair to him, recount my own adventures to him, and inform him of the unfortunate circumstances of my life that have led to my making the acquaintance of such a woman. This honest and sensitive young man shows me the warmest gratitude for the service that I wish to do him. He is interested in my misfortunes, and proposes to alleviate them a little with the gift of his hand in marriage.
I am more than happy to be able to repair the wrongs that fortune has done you, mademoiselle, he said to me. I am my own master. I am answerable to no one. I am going to Geneva to make a considerable investment of sums that your good advice has prevented me from losing, and you must follow me there. When we have arrived, I shall become your husband, and you will appear in Lyon in this position alone. Or if you prefer, mademoiselle, if I do not have your complete trust, I shall give you my name in my native land.
I was too flattered by such an offer to dare to refuse, but neither did I feel it appropriate to accept without making Dubreuil aware of all the reasons why he might come to regret making it. He was grateful to me for my sensitivity, and pressed me all the more insistently. Wretched creature that I was, must happiness offer itself to me only to penetrate me more deeply with the sorrow of never being able to seize hold of it? Must it then be so that no virtue could take root in my heart without preparing torments for me? Our conversation had already taken us 2 leagues from town, and we were about to get out to enjoy the cool air in avenues bordering the Isère, where we planned to walk, when suddenly Dubreuil told me that he felt ill. He gets out and is seized with a dreadful fit of vomiting. I immediately have him put back in the carriage, and we make haste to drive back into town. Dubreuil is so ill that he has to be carried up to his bedchamber. His associate, whom we find there, and who, as ordered, has not left the room, is astonished by his condition. A physician arrives. Dear heaven, Dubreuil has been poisoned. Scarcely have I heard this fateful news than I run to Dubois' apartment. The wretched woman. She's gone. I go to my room. My cupboard has been forced open, and the little money and clothing I possess has been taken. Dubois, I am assured, has been heading in the direction of Turin for the last 3 hours. There was no doubt that she was the author of all these crimes. She has called on Dubreuil, annoyed to find someone with him. She had avenged herself on me and had poisoned Dubreuil during dinner, so that subsequently, when she had succeeded in robbing him, the unfortunate young man would be more concerned with staying alive than with chasing after the woman who had stolen his fortune, and would let her safely escape. The event of his death happening in my arms, so to speak, I might more readily be suspected of it than her. There was nothing to confirm her machinations, but how could they possibly have been any different? I hurry back to Dubreuil's chamber. I am no longer allowed near him. I complain about this denial, and am informed of the reason. The unfortunate man is expiring, and his only concern henceforth is the Lord. However, he has declared me free of all blame. I am innocent, he assures them. He expressly forbids that I be charged. He dies. Scarcely has he closed his eyes than his associate makes haste to come with news for me, begging me to calm down. Alas, how could I do so? How could I not weep bitter tears over the loss of a man who had so generously offered to drag me from the gutter? How could I not deplore a theft that plunged me back into the misery which I had only just left behind? Frightful creature, I cried. If this is where your principles have brought you, is it any wonder that they are abhorred, and that honest people punish them? But I was reasoning as the injured party, and Dubois, who saw only her own happiness and her own interests in what she had undertaken, doubtless reached quite different conclusions. I confided everything in Dubreuil's associate, whose name was Valbois, both what had been plotted against the friend he had lost, and what had happened to me. He pitied me, sincerely regretted the loss of Dubreuil, and blamed the excess of delicacy that had prevented me from going to the authorities as soon as I had learned of Dubois' plans. We agreed that this monster, who required only 4 hours to reach safety in another land, would get there before we could arrange for her to be pursued, that it would cost us a lot of money, that the master of the inn, who would be deeply compromised in any suit we might bring, and who would defend himself impressively, would perhaps end up destroying me. I, who seemed to breathe easily in Grenoble, having barely escaped the gallows. These reasons convinced me, and even frightened me so much, that I resolved to leave this town without taking leave of Monsieur S., my protector. Dubreuil's friend approved of this plan. He did not hide from me that if this whole episode came to light, the depositions he would be obliged to make would compromise me, whatever precautions he might take, as much because of my intimacy with Dubois as because of my last walk with his friend, that he therefore advised me accordingly to leave immediately without seeing anyone, in the safe knowledge that for his part he would never take action against me, believing me to be innocent and being unable to accuse me of anything but weakness in all that had just taken place. Thinking about Valbois' advice, I recognized that it was all the more sound, in that it seemed just as certain that I appeared guilty as it did that I was not, that the only thing that spoke in my favour, the advice given to Dubreuil during the walk, and which, I had been told, was not clearly expressed by him at the moment of death, would not be such overwhelming proof that I could count upon it. In view of all this, I quickly made up my mind and told Valbois. "I would have liked my friend to have given me favourable instructions about you," he said to me. "I should have carried them out with the greatest of pleasure. I would even have liked him to tell me that it was you who advised him to stay in his room, but he did none of this. I am therefore obliged to restrict myself to executing his orders alone. The misfortunes that you have experienced for his sake would determine me to do something for you myself, if I could,
but I am young with a limited fortune, and I am obliged to deliver Dupré's accounts to his family without delay. Permit me, therefore, to limit myself to this one small favour which I beg you to accept. Here are 5 louis, and there is an honest merchant woman from Chalon-sur-Saône, my homeland. She is returning there after a 24-hour stay in Lyon, where she was called on business. I am putting you in her hands. Madame Bertrand, continued Valbois, taking me to this woman. This is the young person I spoke to you about. I commend her to you. She wishes to find a position. I beg you as earnestly as if she were my own sister to do all you can to find something for her in our city, in keeping with her person, her origins, and her upbringing, and that until that time she should not have to pay anything. And I will account to you for everything when I next see you. Adieu, mademoiselle, continued Valbois, asking my permission to embrace me. Madame Bertrand is leaving tomorrow at dawn. Go with her, and may a little more happiness follow you to a town where I shall perhaps have the satisfaction of seeing you again soon. The honesty of this young man, who at bottom owed me nothing, made me weep. Courteous behaviour is sweetest when you have experienced odious conduct for so long. I accepted his favours, swearing to him that I was going to devote all my efforts to making myself able to repay them one day. Alas, I thought as I retired, if the exercise of a new virtue has just plunged me into misfortune, at least for the first time in my life, the hope of consolation presents itself in this horrific abyss of evils into which virtue plunges me once again. It was early in the morning. The need to breathe fresh air made me go down to the banks of the Isère, with a view to walking there for a few moments, and as often happens in such cases, my reveries took me a long way along the path. Finding myself in an isolated spot, I sat down there to think at greater leisure. Meanwhile, night came on without my thinking of retiring to bed, when suddenly I felt myself seized by 3 men. One places his hand over my mouth, and the other 2 hurriedly bundle me into a carriage, getting in after me, and we drive like the wind for a good 3 hours without any of these brigands deigning either to say a single word to me or to respond to any of my questions. The shutters were down, and I could not see anything. The carriage arrives near a house, gates open to let it in, and close again immediately. My abductors carry me inside and through a number of dimly lit apartments, leaving me eventually in one of them, next to which is a room from which I can see a light shining.
"Stay here," one of my abductors says to me, going off with his companions. "You will soon see people you know."
And they disappear, locking all the doors carefully behind them. At almost the same time, the door of the chamber where I could see candlelight opens, and from it I see emerge a candle in her hand. Oh, madame, guess who this might be? Dubois. None other than Dubois, that horrible monster, eaten away, no doubt, by the most ardent desire for revenge.
"Come here, charming girl," she says to me arrogantly. "Come and receive the reward for the virtues you indulge yourself in at my expense."
And angrily squeezing my hand,
"Oh, you villain! I'll teach you to betray me!"
"No, no, madame," I quickly said to her. "No, I have not betrayed you. Make inquiries. I have not made the slightest complaint that could give you concern. I have not said the least word that might compromise you."
"But were you not opposed to the crime that I was planning? Did you not prevent it, shameful creature? You must be punished for it."
And as we were going inside, she did not have time to say any more about it. The apartment that I was shown into was as sumptuous as it was magnificently lit. At the far end, on an ottoman, was a man of about 40 in a dressing gown of flowing taffeta, whom I shall describe to you shortly.
"Monseigneur," said Dubois, presenting me to him. "Here is the young person that you requested, the girl that all Grenoble is interested in. The famous Thérèse, in short, sentenced to be hanged with counterfeiters, and then released because of her innocence and her virtue.
See how skillful I am in serving you, Monseigneur. 4 days ago, you told me of your keen desire to sacrifice her to your passions, and I am delivering her to you today. Perhaps you will prefer her to that pretty boarder in the Benedictine monastery in Lyon that you also wanted, and who is due to arrive at any moment. That girl's physical and moral virtue is still intact, whereas this one only remains virtuous in her sentiments. But virtue is a part of her existence, and nowhere will you find a creature of greater candor and honesty. Both girls are yours, Monseigneur. You can either dispatch both this evening, or one today and the other tomorrow. As for me, I am leaving you now. The kindness you have shown me obliges me to tell you about my experiences in Grenoble. A man dead, Monseigneur, a man dead, and I must flee.
Oh, no, no, charming woman, cried the master of the house. No, stay, and you need fear nothing under my protection. You are the soul of my pleasures. You alone possess the skill to arouse and satisfy them, and the more you multiply your crimes, the more you set my passions alight. But she's pretty, this Thérèse.
And addressing me,
how old are you, my child?
26, Monseigneur, I replied, and full of woe.
Yes, woe, misfortune, I know all that. It's what amuses me. It's what I wanted. We shall put all this to rights and put an end to your reverses. I assure you that in 24 hours you will no longer be unhappy.
And with bursts of horrendous laughter,
is it not the case, Dubois, that I have a sure means of ending a girl's misfortunes?
Assuredly, said this odious creature. And if Thérèse were not one of my friends, I should not have brought her to you. But it is only fair that I reward her for what she has done for me. You could never imagine, Monseigneur, how much this dear creature has been useful to me in my latest enterprise in Grenoble. You have offered to pay my debt of gratitude for me, and I beg you to acquit this debt in full.
The obscurity of these remarks, the observations that Dubois had made to me when we came in, the type of man I was dealing with, this young girl who was yet to arrive, all this instantly filled my imagination with an anxiety that it would be hard to describe to you. A cold sweat exhales from my pores, and I am on the point of fainting. This is the moment when I finally understand what this man is about. He calls me to him. He begins with 2 or 3 kisses, forcing our mouths together. He takes my tongue, he sucks it, and shoves his own down my throat, seeming to pump up my very breath. He pushes my head onto his chest, and lifting my hair, carefully examines the nape of my neck.
Oh, it's delicious, he cries, squeezing hard this part of my body. I've never seen anything so well attached. How divine it would be to sever it.
This last remark removed all my doubts. I clearly saw that I was again at the house of one of those libertines with cruel passions, whose dearest pleasures consisted in the enjoyment of the pain or the death of the unfortunate victims procured for them with money, and that I ran the risk of losing my life there. At that moment, there was a knock at the door. Dubois went out and immediately brought back the young girl from Lyon of whom she had just spoken. Let us try now to describe to you the 2 new characters you are going to see me with. The Monseigneur, whose name or position I never knew, was, as I have told you, a man of 40 years, thin and scrawny but vigorously constituted. Muscles that were almost always bulging stuck out of arms that were covered in coarse black hairs, proclaiming both good health and strength. His face was a fiery red, his eyes small, black and mean. He had fine teeth, and there was spirit in all his features. His well-shaped figure was well above the average, and his love-stick, which I had only too often the occasion to see and feel, was 1 foot in length with a circumference of more than 8 inches. This instrument, lean and sinewy, constantly foaming, and upon which could be seen thick veins, making it even more redoubtable, was erect for the entire 5 or 6 hours that this session lasted, without going limp for a single minute. I had never before come across such a hairy man. He resembled those fawns that fable describes to us. His dry, calloused hands ended in fingers that gripped like a vice. As for his temperament, it seemed harsh, abrupt, and cruel to me, tending to a type of sarcasm or teasing intended to increase the misery that one clearly had to expect from such a man. Eulalie was the name of the young girl from Lyon. You only had to see her to realize how virtuous and well-bred she was. She was the daughter of one of the best families in the town, from which Dubois' female criminals had abducted her, on the pretext of reuniting her with a lover she idolized. In addition to an enchanting naivety and candor, she possessed one of the most delicious physiognomies that it is possible to imagine. Scarcely 16 years old, Eulalie had a real look of the virgin. Her innocence and modesty matched her features and embellished them. She had little color, but this made her all the more fetching, and the luster of her lovely dark eyes gave her pretty countenance all the fire of which her pallor seemed at first to deprive her. Her mouth, a little on the large side, was furnished with the most beautiful teeth, and her bosom, which was already well formed, seemed even whiter than her complexion. She was as pretty as a picture, but none of this was at the expense of a generous and well-rounded figure, with firm, but soft, plump, and dimpled flesh all over. Dubois claimed that it was impossible to see a lovelier arse. Being little acquainted with this part of the body, you will permit me to remain uncommitted on this point. A faint moss covered the front, and magnificent blonde hair hung loosely over all these charms, making them all the more piquant. To complete her masterpiece, nature, which seemed to have taken pleasure in sculpting it, had endowed her with the sweetest and most amiable of characters. Tender and delicate flower, you were born to adorn the earth for no more than an instant before immediately withering.
"Oh, madame," she said to Dubois, recognizing her, "is this how you betray me? Dear heaven, where have you brought me?"
"You shall see, my child,"
the master of the house said to her, roughly pulling her towards him and already starting to kiss her, while I aroused him with one hand as instructed by him. Eulalie tried to defend herself, but Dubois was pushing her onto this libertine, making it impossible for her to extricate herself. The session was a long one. The fresher the flower, the more this foul hornet enjoyed pumping it. This repeated sucking was followed by the inspection of her neck, and as I squeezed it, I felt the member I was stimulating become even more energized.
"Come," said Monseigneur, "here are two victims I will really enjoy. You shall be well paid, Dubois, for I am well served. Let's go into my boudoir. Follow us, dear woman. Follow us," he continued, taking us with him. "You shall leave tonight, but I have need of you for this evening."
Dubois agrees, and we move to the libertine's pleasure chamber, where we are made to strip naked. Oh, madame, I shall not undertake to describe to you the infamies of which I was both witness and victim. The pleasures of this monster were those of an executioner. His sole delight consisted in cutting off heads. My unfortunate companion. Oh, no, madame. Oh, no, don't make me go on. I was to suffer the same fate. Encouraged by Dubois, the monster was determined to make my suffering even more horrible, when the need to restore their strength required the two of them to sit down to eat. What debauchery! But how can I complain about this since it saved my life? Having consumed excessive quantities of wine and food, both of them collapsed dead drunk among the remains of their supper. No sooner do I see them in this state than I grab a petticoat and cloak that Dubois has just taken off to make her even more immodest in her boss's eyes. I take a candle and dash towards the stairs. The house, having few servants, offers no opposition to my flight. I speak to the only one I come across, who has the terrified look of someone racing to the side of her dying master, and I reach the front door without encountering any further resistance. I did not know the roads, as I had not been allowed to see them, and so I take the first one I come across. It is the road to Grenoble. All goes well, when fortune deigns to smile upon us for a while. People were still sleeping in the inn, and I enter unseen and run as fast as I can to Valbois's chamber.
I knock. Valbois awakes and scarcely recognizes me in the state I am in. He asks me what has happened to me, and I tell him of all the horrors of which I have just been both victim and witness. "You can have Dubois arrested," I said to him. "She is not far from here. Perhaps it will be possible for me to give directions. In addition to all her crimes, the wretched woman has also taken my old clothes and the 5 louis that you gave me."
"Oh, Thérèse," Valbois said to me, "you are assuredly the most unfortunate girl in the world, and yet, as you can see, honest creature, in the midst of all the ills that befall you, the hand of the Lord protects you. This should be one more reason for you to continue to be virtuous. Good actions do not go unrewarded. We shall not prosecute Dubois. My reasons for leaving her alone are the same as those I outlined to you yesterday. Let us just make up for the wrongs she has done you. First, here is the money she took from you."
1 hour later, a dressmaker brought me 2 sets of clothing and some linen.
"But you must leave, Thérèse," Valbois said to me. "You must leave this very day. Madame Bertrand is expecting you. I have persuaded her to delay her departure on your account by a few hours. Go and join her."
"Oh, virtuous young man," I cried, falling into the arms of my benefactor. "May heaven one day return all the acts of kindness you do me."
"Come, Thérèse," Valbois replied, embracing me. "I already possess the happiness you wish for me, since it is my task to make you happy. Farewell."
This is how I came to leave Grenoble, madame, and if I did not find in this town all the felicity that I had expected to find there, in no other town at least have I met in a single place so many honest people to pity and soothe my pain. My driver and I were in a little covered wagon, pulled by 1 horse which we guided from the rear of this vehicle. In it were also Madame Bertrand's merchandise, and a little girl of 15 months that she was still suckling, and for whom, to my misfortune, I quickly developed as close an affection as she who gave birth to her could have done. In any case, that Bertrand was a really nasty, suspicious, gossipy, annoying woman of limited intellect. We would regularly take all her belongings into the inn each evening, and we slept in the same room. All went very well until we reached Lyon. But during the course of the 3 days this woman needed for her business, I came across someone in this town whom I was far from expecting to meet. I was walking in the afternoon along the Quai du Rhône with one of the girls from the inn whom I had asked to accompany me, when I suddenly caught sight of the Reverend Father Antonin from Sainte-Marie-des-Bois, now Father Superior of the house of his order in this city. This monk approaches me, and having in a low voice bitterly reproached me for having fled, and having given me to understand that I was running serious risks of being recaptured should he warn the monastery of Burgundy, he added in gentler tones that he would say nothing if I agreed that very instant to come and see him in his new home with the girl who was with me, and who seemed to him a legitimate prize. Then, making the same proposal aloud to this creature,
"We will pay you both well," said the monster. "There are 10 of us in our house, and I promise each of you at least 1 louis if your acquiescence is unlimited."
I blushed profusely at this proposition. I try to convince the monk that he is mistaken, but having no success, I try to restrain him with gestures, but nothing manages to fend off this insolent man, and his solicitations grow still more animated. As we have repeatedly refused to follow him, he eventually reduces his demands to asking insistently for our address. In order to get rid of him, I give him a false one. He writes it in his pocketbook and takes leave of us, assuring us that he will see us again soon. While we were returning to the inn, I explained as best I could the story of this unfortunate acquaintance to the girl who was with me, but either what I said to her did not satisfy her, or perhaps such an act of virtue on my part made her very angry, as it deprived her of an adventure from which she would have earned so much, because she did not keep silent. This was made only too clear to me by remarks of Bertrand's on the occasion of the dreadful catastrophe that I shall soon recount to you. However, the monk did not reappear, and we left. Having left Lyon late in the day, we were obliged to spend the first night in Villefranche, and it was there, madame, that I experienced the awful misfortune that led to my appearing before you today as a criminal, without my being any more responsible for this unhappy circumstance of my life than for any of those in which you have seen me so unjustly buffeted by the blows of fate, and without anything plunging me into the abyss but the goodness of my heart and the wickedness of men. Having arrived in Villefranche at around 6 o'clock in the evening, we had lost no time in having supper and retiring in order to undertake a more strenuous journey the next day. We had been resting for no more than a couple of hours when we were awoken by terrifying smoke. Persuaded that there is fire close by, we leave our beds in a hurry. Dear heaven, the fire had already spread to a frightening extent. We open our door half naked, and all we can hear around us is the crashing sound of walls collapsing, the noise of timber cracking, and the horrific screams of people falling into the flames. Surrounded by these all-consuming flames, we are already unable to find a way out. In order to escape their intensity, we plunge into their very source and are soon caught up in the crowd of unfortunates who, like us, are searching for a way to safety. I remember that it did not occur to my guide, who was then more concerned about herself than about her daughter, to save her life. Without telling her, I run to our room through the flames that are close enough to burn me in several places. I grab hold of the poor little creature. I hurry to take her back to her mother, supporting myself on a beam that is half consumed by the fire. I miss my footing, and my initial reaction is to put my hands out in front of me. This natural instinct forces me to let go of the precious burden I am holding. It slips from my grasp, and the poor child falls into the fire before her mother's very eyes. I am dragged away. Too upset to make anything out, I can't tell whether I am surrounded by friends or foes, but to my misfortune, I am all too quickly enlightened on this question when, thrown into a postchaise, I find myself sitting beside Dubois, who, placing a pistol against my temple, threatens to blow my brains out if I utter a word.
"Oh, you villain," she says to me. "I've got you now for what you did, and this time you shall not escape."
"Oh, madame, what are you doing here?" I cried.
"Everything that has just happened was my work," the monster replied. "It was thanks to a fire that I saved your life, and that's how you're going to lose it. I would have pursued you into the fires of hell, if necessary, to get you back. Monseigneur was furious when he learnt of your escape. I get 200 louis for each girl I obtain for him, and not only did he not want to pay me for Eulalie, but he threatened to bring the full force of his anger down on my head if I did not bring you back. I found out where you were, and I missed you in Lyon by 2 hours. Yesterday I arrived in Villefranche 1 hour after you, and I had henchmen that I always have in my pay set fire to the inn. If I could not have you, I wanted to burn you to death. Now that I have you, I am taking you back to a house that your flight threw into chaos and anxiety, and I am bringing you back there, Thérèse, to be cruelly treated. Monseigneur has sworn that there would be no torture terrifying enough for you, and we will be at his house the moment we leave this coach. Well, Thérèse, what do you think now of virtue?" "Oh, madame, that it is often the victim of crime, that it is happy when it triumphs, but that if man's heinous crimes succeed in crushing it on earth, it will surely be the sole object of divine reward in heaven. It won't be long, Thérèse, before you find out whether there really is a God who punishes or rewards the actions of men. Oh, if in the eternal nothingness which you are about to enter you were allowed to think, how you would regret the fruitless sacrifices that your stubbornness has forced you to make to phantoms that have only ever repaid you with misfortune. Thérèse, there is still time. I can save you if you agree to be my accomplice. I cannot bear to see you constantly coming to grief on the dangerous roads to virtue. What? Are you not yet punished enough for your good conduct and your false principles? How many misfortunes do you need to change your ways? How many more examples are required to convince you that the course you are taking is the worst one of all, and that, as I have told you 1,000 times, you can expect nothing but setbacks when you go against the grain and try to be the only virtuous one in a society that is completely corrupt? You're counting on an avenging deity. Undeceive yourself, Therese. Undeceive yourself. The god that you have invented for yourself is nothing but an illusion, the stupid existence of which was only ever to be found in the minds of madmen. It is a phantom invented by the wickedness of men, the aim of which is to deceive others or to arm one group against another. The most valuable service that one could have done them would have been immediately to cut the throat of the first impostor who took it into his head to speak to them of a god. How much blood just one murder would have spared the world! Come, come, Therese. A nature that is constantly active, constantly in motion, has no need of a master to direct it. And even if this master did indeed exist, after all the faults with which he has filled his works, would he deserve anything from us but insults and contempt? Oh, if he does exist, your god, how much I detest him, Therese! How much I abhor him! Yes, if he really did exist, I admit, the sole pleasure of perpetually annoying such a being would become the most precious recompense for the need I would then have to concede a measure of belief in him. Once more I ask, Therese, will you become my accomplice? A superb opportunity presents itself, and we will execute it with courage. If you undertake it, I will save your life. The lord whose house we are visiting, and whom you know, lives alone in the country residence where he holds his parties. You know that the kind of parties they are requires this. One servant only accompanies him when he goes there for his pleasures. The man who runs ahead of this chaise, and you and me, dear girl, that makes 3 against 2. When this libertine is hot with lust, I shall seize the sabre with which he ends the lives of his victims. You will hold him, we will kill him, and meanwhile my man will knock out his valet. There is money hidden in that house. More than 800,000 francs, Therese. I am sure of it. The job is well worth it. Choose, wise creature. Choose to die or to serve me. If you betray me, if you tell him about my plans, I shall accuse you alone, and be in no doubt that I shall prevail, given the trust he has always had in me. Think carefully before giving me your answer. This man is a rogue, and so in killing him we are merely serving the laws whose rigour he has deserved. There is not a single day, Therese, when this rascal does not murder a girl, and therefore, in punishing crime, how can we be outraging virtue? How can the very reasonable proposal I am making you offend against your strict principles?
I have no doubt whatever, madame, I replied, that it is not in order to punish crime that you are suggesting this act to me. It is with the sole purpose of committing one yourself. To do what you are suggesting can therefore be nothing but a very great evil with no semblance of legitimacy. In any case, even if your aim were to avenge humanity for this man's horrors, you would still be doing evil in undertaking it, this task being no concern of yours. The laws are made to punish the guilty, and we should leave it to them to do their job. The Supreme Being has not entrusted their sword into our feeble hands. We would not use it without offending against them ourselves.
Well, then you shall die, disgraceful creature, replied Dubois angrily. You shall die! So you should not entertain any further hopes of escaping your fate.
What does it matter to me? I calmly replied. I shall be delivered from all my woes. Death holds no terrors for me. It is life's last sleep, the repose of the unfortunate. And with these words, the ferocious beast hurled herself at me so that I thought she would strangle me. She struck me several times on the breast, but let go of me as soon as I cried out for fear that the postillion might hear me. In the meantime, we were making good progress. The man who ran ahead was preparing fresh horses for us,
and we did not stop at any staging post. As the horses were being changed, Dubois again took her weapon and held it against my heart. What was I to do? In truth, I was in such low spirits as a result of my weakness and the situation I was in that I preferred death to the difficult measures necessary to save myself from it. We were just about to enter the Dauphiné when 6 men on horseback, galloping up at full speed behind our carriage, reached it and, sabres in hand, forced our postillion to stop. 30 feet from the road was a cottage where these riders, whom we soon recognised as being from the mounted constabulary, ordered the driver to take the coach. Once it is there, they make us get out, and we all enter the peasant's home. Dubois, with unimaginable effrontery in a woman steeped in crimes and who finds herself under arrest, asked these troopers in a haughty voice if they knew who she was, and what gave them the right to treat a lady of her rank in such a fashion.
"We do not have the honour of your acquaintance, madame," said the officer in charge, "but we are sure that you have in your carriage a wretched girl who yesterday set fire to the main inn in Villefranche." Then, looking me up and down, "She fits her description, madame. We are not mistaken. Have the goodness to hand her over to us, and to inform us how a person as respectable as you appear to be can have taken charge of such a woman."
"The explanation is a perfectly simple one," replied Dubois, more impudent than ever, "and I would neither wish to conceal this girl from you, nor to take her part. If it is certain that she is guilty of the dreadful crime you speak of, like her, I was lodging yesterday at this inn in Villefranche. I left in the midst of the commotion, and as I was getting into the carriage, this girl ran to me to implore my compassion, saying that she had just lost everything in the fire, that she begged me to take her with me as far as Lyon, where she hoped to find a position. Listening less to my reason than my heart, I agreed to her requests. Once in my carriage, she offered to serve me. Once again, imprudently, I agreed to everything, and I was taking her to the Dauphiné, where my property and family are. Most certainly I have learned a lesson here, and I now recognise all too clearly the drawbacks of pity. I shall not repeat this mistake. There she is, monsieur. There she is. Heaven forfend that I should be involved with such a monster. I deliver her to the full force of the law, and I beg you to take no account at all of my unfortunate willingness to believe her for a single moment."
I tried to defend myself. I tried to denounce the real guilty party. But my pleadings were treated as slanderous recriminations, against which Dubois defended herself with naught but a scornful smile. "Oh, baneful consequences of misery and prejudice, of wealth and impudence! Was it possible that a woman who called herself Madame la Baronne de Foulconi, who paraded her wealth, who claimed to possess lands, a family tree, how could such a woman be guilty of a crime in which she did not appear to have the least financial interest? On the other hand, did not everything condemn me? I was without protection. I was poor. It was obvious that I was guilty." The officer in charge read me Bertrand's accusations. She it was who had accused me. According to her, I had set fire to the inn the more easily to rob her, and she had lost every single penny. I had thrown her child into the fire so that the despair into which this event would plunge her would blind her to all else and prevent her from being aware of my machinations. Moreover, Bertrand had added I was a loose woman, one who had escaped the gallows in Grenoble, and whom she had stupidly taken on out of an excess of kindness for a young man from her region, doubtless my lover. I had publicly, and in broad daylight, accosted monks in Lyon. In short, there was nothing that this shameful creature would not have exploited to condemn me, nothing that her calumny, embittered by despair, would not have invented to vilify me. At this woman's behest, a judicial hearing had been held at the scene. The fire had started in a hayloft, which several persons had sworn I had entered on the evening of that grim day. And this was true. Looking for a water closet, I had been given the wrong directions by a servant I had asked, and had gone into that loft, without finding the place I was searching for, and had stayed there for long enough to be suspected of the crime of which I was accused, or at least to suggest this was probable. And as we know, in our century, this is as good as proof positive. There was therefore no point in defending myself, and the officer's sole response was to prepare to clap me in irons. "But, monsieur," I said again before allowing them to put me in chains, "if I had robbed my travelling companion in Villefranche, the money should still be on my person. Let them search me." This artless defence just made them laugh. They were in no doubt that I was not alone. They were sure I had accomplices to whom I had passed on the stolen money as I fled. Then the wicked Dubois, who knew about the brand I had had the misfortune to receive long ago when I was at Rodin's, pretended to take pity on me for a moment.
"Monsieur,"
she said to the officer,
"so many mistakes are made each day in these matters, so you will forgive me if I make a suggestion. If this girl is guilty of the action she is accused of, it will probably not be her first offence. People don't get to commit crimes of this nature in one day. Examine this girl. I beg you, monsieur, if by chance you were to find on her wretched body... But if you find no reason to suspect her, allow me to defend and protect her."
The officer agreed to the examination, which was about to be carried out.
"One moment, monsieur," I said, resisting. "There's no point in examining me. Madame knows full well that I bear this dreadful brand. She also knows full well what caused it. This subterfuge on her part is just one more horror that will be exposed along with everything else in the Temple of Temis itself. Take me there, monsieur. Here are my hands. Bind them in chains. Only crime blushes to bear them. Wretched virtue groans beneath them and is not afraid."
"In truth, I would never have thought," said Dubois, "that my idea would be so successful. But as this creature rewards me for the kindnesses I have shown her with insidious accusations, I am prepared to return with her if necessary."
"There is absolutely no point in doing so, Madame la Baronne," said the officer. "Our investigations are concerned only with this girl. Her confessions, the brand she bears, everything condemns her. We have no need of anyone but her. And we ask 1,000 pardons for having taken up so much of your time."
I was immediately chained and pulled up behind one of these troopers. Dubois departed, with the final insult of the gift of a few écus to my guards, out of commiseration for my situation in the sad place I would be living in while awaiting my new quarters.
"Oh, virtue,"
I cried when I saw myself so dreadfully humiliated.
"Could you be any more stingingly insulted than this? How was it possible for crime to dare confront and defeat you with so much insolence and impunity?"
We soon arrived in Lyon, and immediately on arrival, I was thrown into the criminal's dungeon and was committed there as an arsonist, fallen woman, child murderer, and thief. 7 persons had been burnt alive in the inn. I had thought I would be one of them myself. I had tried to save a child. I was going to die. But she, who was the cause of this horror, was escaping the vigilance of the laws and heavenly justice. She was triumphant, going on to commit new crimes, while innocent and wretched, I could look forward only to dishonour, branding, and death. For so long accustomed to calumnies, injustice and misfortune, used since childhood to embracing sentiments of virtue, only to be certain of encountering thorns, my pain was more numb than heart-rending, and I wept less than I would have imagined. However, as it is natural for the suffering creature to seek all possible means to extract itself from the abyss into which its misfortune has plunged it, Father Antonin came to my mind. However feeble the help I might hope to get from him, I would not deny myself the wish to see him. I asked for him, and he appeared. He had not been told who had requested his presence, and he affected not to recognize me, so I told the concierge that it was indeed possible that he did not remember me, having acted as my spiritual adviser when I was very young, but that, by virtue of our past acquaintance, I would like to meet with him in private. This was agreed on both sides. As soon as I was alone with this cleric, I threw myself at his feet and bathed them with my tears imploring him to save me from the cruel situation in which I found myself. I demonstrated my innocence to him. I did not conceal from him that the indecent proposals he had made to me a few days earlier had set against me the person to whom I was recommended, and who now was my accuser.